Blog Talk Radio. Greetings, this is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Friday, April 5th, 2024, and we're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast. And later on in our program, we'll be bringing you our regular Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day. And of course, we'll be covering issues which are covered on a daily basis by the Pan-African News Wire. And right now we'd like to move into our musical interlude. And of course, our musical interlude today will feature the legendary Nigerian artist, Tony Allen. And of course, Tony Allen is from the West African state of Nigeria. Let's listen in.
Oje ni won yo, oje ni won yo. Only what do they want is give on my pizza, yeah. Only what do they want is we'll be right back.
Thank you. Shall we fun e o bi nipa ti asiko ba wa to bi wa wa ri wi pe se oje ni won yo bi oje ni won yo. Go by what do you Thank you.
Stand. Black voices, stand, beware.
Percussionist, composer, artist, Tony Allen from the West African state of the Federal Republic of Nigeria. That album was entitled Black Voices. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for this Friday, April 5th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. Right now, we'd like to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment, and these are some of the headlines in today's Pan-African Newswire. In the West Asian state of Yemen, the Ansar Allah leader says the Al-Quds Platform Day is an occasion aimed at raising awareness and reviving the sense of responsibility towards the non-negotiable Palestinian cause. The leader of the Yemeni Ansar Allah movement, Saeed Abdul Malik Al-Houthi, said that the Israeli occupation, quote, for half a year has been committing genocide against the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip, unquote. In a televised speech on the occasion of the Al-Quds Platform Day, Saeed Al-Houthi said that the Israeli occupation, quote, seeks to turn the Gaza Strip into an uninhabitable area through comprehensive destruction, unquote. He emphasized that, quote, what the Israeli enemy did in the Al-Shifa medical complex is one of the worst crimes of genocide and one of the most atrocious, unquote, pointing out that providing scarce aid is a means to killing Palestinians. The United States and the West are complicit in Israeli aggression. Regarding the American and Western roles in the ongoing battle, Saeed Al-Houthi pointed to, quote, the tolerant stance of the government to which foreign relief workers belong, who were targeted by the Israeli occupation, unquote. He spoke of American involvement in, quote, genocidal crimes in various forms with weapons, experts, and information, unquote, noting that, quote, Americans continue to support the Israeli enemy and share with it the criminal tendency to exterminate the Palestinian people, unquote. You can read this article in its entirety over the Pan-African Newswire. In the North African state of Sudan, Sudan's prosecution has accused former Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok two days ago, of, quote, inciting war against the state, unquote. This was carried out on April 3rd. In addition to other charges that could carry the death penalty, as reported by state television, 15 other people who also reside abroad, like Hamdok, including journalists and politicians, are looking at similar charges, such as, quote, violating the Constitution, unquote. Battles between the Sudanese army and the rapid support forces have been ongoing since April of 2023, nearly 1 year ago. Sudan's armed forces on March 12 announced that it had regained control over national radio and television headquarters in the city of Omdurman from the rapid support forces, the RSF paramilitary groups. Quote, your armed forces and other regular forces and sons of this country that are working alongside the army have today succeeded in forcing the headquarters of the National Cooperation for Television and Radio, History and love of the Sudanese people from the terrorist RSF chief Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo militia and near mercenaries from other countries, the military said in a statement. Over tens of thousands of people have been killed and more than 8 million were displaced since April of 2023. They've been displaced from their homes due to the conflict, making it the world's largest displacement crisis. On March 11th, it witnessed a heightened clashes breaking out between the two groups on multiple fronts in Khartoum, the capital. The fighting occurred despite a recent UN Security Council resolution urging both parties to cease hostilities during the month of Ramadan. Quote, there will not be a ceasefire during Ramadan unless the opposition group leaves civilian homes and facilities, unquote, said the Sudanese Armed Forces General Yasser al-Atta. He made this statement on March the 10th. And you're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In other news, there has been a unified statement between states in the Caribbean and on the African continent. Support is building among African and Caribbean nations for the creation of an international tribunal on atrocities dating to the transatlantic trade of enslaved people, with the United States backing the UN panel at the heart of the effort. A tribunal modeled on other ad hoc courts, such as the Nuremberg trials of Nazi war criminals after World War II, was proposed last year. It has now gained traction within a broader slavery reparations movement. That's according to the international press. Formally recommended in June by the United Nations Permanent Forum on Peoples of African Descent, the idea of a special tribunal has been explored further at African and Caribbean regional bodies, said Eric Phillips, a vice chair of the Slavery Reparations Commission for the Caribbean Community, CARICOM, which groups 15 member states. The scope of any tribunal has not been determined, but the UN forum recommended in a preliminary report that it should address reparations for enslavement, apartheid, genocide, and colonialism. Advocates included within the CARICOM and the African Union, which groups 55 nations across the continent, are working to build wider backing for the idea among UN members, Phillips said. And finally, in this segment, the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal, the president of the East African state of Kenya, William Ruto, has visited the West African state of Ghana. It was the first such pitch by President Ruto in West Africa since they had some form of a handshake with his erstwhile nemesis, Odinga, whom he has since publicly backed to seek the AU top seat. Ruto had pitched to Raila, to neighbors before, but only Rwanda has publicly pledged support yet. Speaking during his state visit to the West African nation, President Ruto said Kenya's candidatures is informed by its leading role in enhancing and sustaining the Pan-African agenda. Quote, this is in terms of independence and sovereignty, peace and security, development and prosperity, as well as sustainability and climate action. We hope to work with all to achieve Africa's 2063 agenda, Ruto said. He lauded President Akufo-Addo for backing the Kenyan's African Union Commission quest. At the joint press conference, Akufo-Addo focused on what it was in it for his country. And you can read these articles in their entirety over the Pan-African Newswire, and that's going to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In concluding this segment of our program, we'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches in hundreds of newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire, so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And if you'd like to have access to the Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast for this Friday, April 5th, 2024, all you need to do is log on to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break, and we'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week. Bowler's Love. That was a track entitled One Rainy Wish. And yesterday represented the 56th anniversary of the martyrdom of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who was gunned down on April 4th of 1968 in Memphis, Tennessee, while he was lending assistance to an African-American sanitation worker strike, which had been going on at that time for 2 months. And we're going to listen to the last speech delivered on April 3rd, 1968, by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to an audience of thousands of blacks in Memphis. Let's listen in.
Thank you very kindly, my friends. As I listen to Ralph Abernathy and his eloquent and generous introduction, and then thought about myself, I wondered who he was talking about. It's always good to have your closest friend and associate to say something good about you. And Ralph Abernathy is the best friend that I have in the world. I'm delighted to see each of you here tonight in spite of a storm warning. You reveal that you are determined to go on anyhow. Something is happening in Memphis. Something is happening in our world. And you know, if I was standing at the beginning of time with the possibility of taking a kind of general and panoramic view of the whole of human history up to now, and the Almighty said to me, Martin Luther King, which age would you like to live in? I would take my mental flight by Egypt. And I would watch God's children in their magnificent trek from the dark dungeons of Egypt through, or rather across the Red Sea, through the wilderness on toward the Promised Land. And in spite of its magnificence, I wouldn't stop there. I would move on by Greece and take my mind to Mount Olympus. And I would see Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, Euripides, and Aristophanes assemble around the Parthenon. And I would watch them around the Parthenon as they discussed the great and eternal issues of reality, but I wouldn't stop there. I would go on even to the great heyday of the Roman Empire. And I would see developments around there through various emperors and leaders. But I wouldn't stop there. I would even come up to the day of the Renaissance and get a quick picture of all that the Renaissance did for the cultural and aesthetic life of man, but I wouldn't stop there. I would even go by the way that the man for whom I'm named had his habitat. And I would watch Martin Luther as he tacks his 95 theses on the door at the Church of Wittenberg, but I wouldn't stop there. I would come on up even to 1863 and watch a vacillating president by the name of Abraham Lincoln finally come to the conclusion that he had to sign the Emancipation Proclamation, but I wouldn't stop there. I would even come up to the early 30s and see a man grappling with the problems of the bankruptcy of his nation and come with an eloquent cry that we have nothing to fear but fear itself. But I wouldn't stop there. Strangely enough, I would turn to the Almighty and say, if you allow me to live just a few years in the second half of the 20th century, I will be happy. Now, that's a strange statement to make because the world is all messed up. The nation is sick. Trouble is in the land. Confusion all around. That's a strange statement. But I know somehow that only when it is dark enough can you see the stars. And I see God working in this period of the 20th century in a way that men in some strange way are responding. Something is happening in our world. The masses of people are rising up, and wherever they are assembled today, whether they are in Johannesburg, South Africa, Nairobi, Kenya, Accra, Ghana, New York City, Atlanta, Georgia, Jackson, Mississippi, or Memphis, Tennessee, the cry is always the same. We want to be free. And another reason that I'm happy to live in this period is that we have been forced to a point where we are going to have to grapple with the problems that men have been trying to grapple with through history, but the demands didn't force them to do it. Survival demands that we grapple with them. Men for years now have been talking about war and peace. But now no longer can they just talk about it. It is no longer the choice between violence and nonviolence in this world. It's nonviolence or non-existence. That is where we are today. And also in the human rights revolution, is something getting done and done in a hurry to bring the colored peoples of the world out of their long years of poverty, their long years of hurt and neglect. The whole world is doomed. Now, I'm just happy that God has allowed me to live in this period, to see what is unfolding. And I'm happy that he's allowed me to be in Memphis. I can remember when Negroes were just going around, as Ralph has said so often, scratching where they didn't itch and laughing when they were not tickled. But that day is all over. We mean business now, and we are determined to gain our rightful place in God's world. And that's all this whole thing is about. We aren't engaged in any negative protest and in any negative arguments with anybody. We are saying that we are determined to be men. We are determined to be people. We are saying, that we are God's children. And if we are God's children, we don't have to live like we are forced to live. Now, what does all of this mean in this great period of history? It means that we've got to stay together. We've got to stay together and maintain unity. You know, whenever Pharaoh wanted to prolong the period of slavery in Egypt, he had a favorite formula for doing it. What was that? He kept the slaves fighting among themselves. But whenever the slaves get together, something happens in Pharaoh's court, and he cannot hold the slaves in slavery. When the slaves get together, that's the beginning of getting out of slavery. Now let us maintain unity. Secondly, let us keep the issues where they are. The issue is injustice. The issue is the refusal of Memphis to be fair and honest in its dealings with its public servants who happen to be sanitation workers. Now we've got to keep attention on that. That's always the problem with a little violence. You know what happened the other day, and the press dealt only with the window breaking. I read the article. They very seldom got around to mentioning the fact that 1,300 sanitation workers are on strike and that Memphis is not being fair to them, and that Mayor Loeb is in dire need of a doctor. They didn't get around to that. Now we're going to march again, and we've got to march again in order to put the issue where it is supposed to be. Force everybody to see that there are 1,300 of God's children here suffering. Sometimes going hungry. Going through dark and dreary nights. Wondering how this thing is going to come out. That's the issue. And we've got to say to the nation, we know how it's coming out. For when people get caught up with that which is right, and they are willing to sacrifice for it, there is no stopping point short of victory. We aren't going to let any may stop us. We are masters in our nonviolent movement. In disarming police forces, they don't know what to do. I've seen them so often. I remember in Birmingham, Alabama, when we were in that majestic struggle there, we would move out of the 16th Street Baptist Church day after day. By the hundreds, we would move out. And Bull Connor would tell them to send the dogs for. And they did come. But we just went before the dogs singing, "Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around." Bull Connor next would say, turn the fire hoses on. And as I said to you the other night, Bull Connor didn't know history. He knew a kind of physics that somehow didn't relate to the transphysics that we knew about. And that was the fact that there was a certain kind of fire that no water could put out. And we went before the fire hoses. We had known water. If we were Baptists or some other denomination, we had been immersed. If we were Methodists and some others, we had been sprinkled. But we knew water. That couldn't stop us. And we just went on before the dogs, and we would look at them, and we'd go on before the water hoses, and we would look at it, and we just go on singing, over my head, I see freedom in the air. And then we would be thrown into paddy wagons, and sometimes we were stacked in there like sardines in a can. And they would throw us in, and old Bull would say, take them off. And they did, and we would just go on in the paddy wagon singing, we shall overcome. And every now and then we'd get in jail and we'd see the jailers looking through the windows, being moved by our prayer and being moved by our words and our songs. And there was a power there which Bull Connor couldn't adjust to. And so we ended up transforming Bull into a steer, and we won our struggle in Birmingham. Now we've got to go on in Memphis just like that. I call upon you to be with us when we go out Monday. Now about injunctions. We have an injunction and we're going into court tomorrow morning to fight this illegal, unconstitutional injunction. All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper. If I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country, maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest for right. And so just as I say, we aren't going to let any dogs a water hose that's turn us around, we aren't going to let any injunction turn us around. We are going on. We need all of you. You know what's beautiful to me? It's to see all of these ministers of the gospel. It's a marvelous picture. Who is it that is supposed to articulate the longings and aspirations of the people more than the preacher? Somehow the preacher must have a kind of fire shut up in his bones. And whenever injustice is around, he must tell it. Somehow the preacher must be an Amos. Said, when God speaks, who can but prophesy? Again with Amos, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. Somehow the preacher must say with Jesus, The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me. And he's anointed me to deal with the problems of the poor. And I want to commend the preachers under the leadership of these noble men, James Lawson, one who has been in this struggle for many years. He's been to jail for struggling. He's been kicked out of Vanderbilt University for this struggling, but he's still going on fighting for the rights of his people. Reverend Ralph Jackson, Billy Kyle, I could just go right on down the list. It's time will not permit, but I want to thank all of them. And I want you to thank them. Because so often, preachers aren't concerned about anything but themselves. And I'm always happy to see a relevant ministry. It's all right to talk about long white robes over yonder in all of its symbolism. But ultimately, people want some suits and dresses and shoes to wear down here. It's all right to talk about streets flowing with milk and honey. But God has commanded us to be concerned about the slums down here and his children who can't eat 3 square meals a day. It's all right to talk about the New Jerusalem, but one day, God's preacher must talk about the New New York, the New Atlanta, the New Philadelphia, the New Los Angeles, the New Memphis, Tennessee. This is what we have to do. Now, the other thing we'll have to do is this. Always anchor our external direct action with the power of economic withdrawal. Now, we are poor people. Individually, we are poor when you compare us with white society in America. We are poor. Never stop and forget that collectively, that means all of us together, collectively we are richer than all the nations in the world with the exception of 9. Did you ever think about that? After you leave the United States, Soviet Russia, Great Britain, West Germany, France, and I could name others, the American Negro collectively is richer than most nations of the world. We have an annual income of more than $30 billion a year, which is more than all of the exports of the United States and more than the national budget of Canada. Did you know that? That's power right there if we know how to pool it. We don't have to argue with anybody. We don't have to curse and go around acting bad with our words. We don't need any bricks and bottles. We don't need any Molotov cocktails. We just need to go around to these stores and to these massive industries in our country and say, God sent us by here to say to you that you're not treating his children right. And we come by here to ask you to make the first item on your agenda fair treatment where God's children are concerned. Now, if you are not prepared to do that, we do have an agenda that we must follow. And our agenda calls for withdrawing economic support from you. So as a result of this, we're asking you tonight to go out and tell your neighbors not to buy Coca-Cola in Memphis. Go by and tell them not to buy sealed test milk. Tell them not to buy, what is the other bread? Wonder Bread. And what is the other bread, come to Jesse? Tell them not to buy Hearts Bread. As Jesse Jackson has said, up to now, only the garbage men have been feeling pain. Now we must kind of redistribute the pain. We are choosing these companies because they haven't been fair in their hiring policies. And we are choosing them because they can begin the process of saying they are going to support the needs and the rights of these men who are on strike. And then they can move on town, downtown, and tell Mayor Loeb to do what is right. And not only that, we've got to strengthen black institutions. I call upon you to take your money out of the banks downtown and deposit your money in Tri-State Bank. We want a bank-in movement in Memphis. Go by the Savings and Loan Association. I'm not asking you something that we don't do ourselves in SCLC. Judge Hooks and others will tell you that we have an account here in the Savings and Loan Association from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. We are telling you to follow what we are doing. Put your money there. You have 6 or 7 black insurance companies here in the city of Memphis. Take out your insurance there. We want to have an insurance in. Now, these are some practical things that we can do. We begin the process of building a great economic base, and at the same time, we are putting pressure where it really hurts. I ask you to follow through here. Now let me say as I move to my conclusion that we've got to give ourselves to this struggle until the end. Nothing would be more tragic than to stop at this point in Memphis. We got to see it through. When we have our march, you need to be there. If it means leaving work, if it means leaving school, be there. Be concerned about your brother. You may not be on strike, but either we go up together or we go down together. Let us develop a kind of dangerous unselfishness. One day a man came to Jesus. He wanted to raise some questions about some vital matters of life. At points, he wanted to trick Jesus and show him that he knew a little more than Jesus knew and throw him off base. Now, that question could have easily ended up in a philosophical and theological debate. But Jesus immediately pulled that question from midair and placed it on the dangerous curve between Jerusalem and Jericho. He talked about a certain man who fell among thieves. You remember that a Levite and a priest passed by on the other side. They didn't stop to help him. Finally, a man of another race came by. He got down from his beast, decided not to be compassionate by proxy. But he got down with him, administered first aid, and helped the man in need. Jesus ended up saying, this was the good man, this was the great man. Because he had the capacity to project the eye into the thou and to be concerned about his brother. Now, you know, we use our imagination a great deal to try to determine why the priest and the Levite didn't stop. The times we say they were busy going to a church meeting, an ecclesiastical gathering, and they had to get on down to Jerusalem so they wouldn't be late for their meeting. At other times, we would speculate that there was a religious law that one who was engaged in religious ceremonial was not to touch a human body 24 hours before the ceremony. And every now and then we begin to wonder whether maybe they were not going down to Jerusalem, down to Jericho rather, to organize a Jericho Road Improvement Association. That's a possibility. Maybe they felt that it was better to deal with the problem from the causal root rather than to get bogged down with an individual effect. But I'm going to tell you what my imagination tells me. It's possible that those men were afraid. You see, the Jericho Road is a dangerous road.
That's right,
I remember when Mrs. King and I were first in Jerusalem. We rented a car and drove from Jerusalem down to Jericho. And as soon as we got on that road, I said to my wife, I can see why Jesus used this as the setting for his parable. It's a winding, meandering road. It's really conducive for ambushing. You start out in Jerusalem, which is about 1,200 miles, or rather 1,200 feet above sea level. And by the time you get down to Jericho, 15 or 20 minutes later, you're about 2,200 feet below sea level. That's a dangerous road. In the days of Jesus, it came to be known as the Bloody Pass. And you know it's possible that the priest and the Levite looked over that man on the ground and wondered if the robbers were still around. Or it's possible that they felt that the man on the ground was merely faking. And he was acting like he had been robbed and hurt in order to seize them over there, lure them there for quick and easy seizure. And so the first question that the priest asked, the first question that the Levite asked was, if I stop to help this man, what will happen to me? But then the Good Samaritan came by, and he reversed the question. If I do not stop to help this man, what will happen to him? That's the question before you tonight. Not if I stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to my job? Not if I stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to all of the hours that I usually spend in my office every day and every week as a pastor? The question is not, if I stop to help this man in need, what will happen to me? The question is, if I do not stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to them? That's the question. Let us rise up tonight with a greater readiness. let us stand with a greater determination and let us move on in these powerful days, these days of challenge, to make America what it ought to be. We have an opportunity to make America a better nation. And I want to thank God once more for allowing me to be here with you. You know, several years ago, I was in New York City autographing the first book that I had written. And while sitting there autographing books, a demented black woman came up. The only question I heard from her was, "Are you Martin Luther King?" And I was looking down writing, and I said, "Yes." The next minute, I felt something beating on my chest. Before I knew it, I had been stabbed by this demented woman. I was rushed to Harlem Hospital. It was a dark Saturday afternoon. That blade had gone through, and the x-rays revealed that the tip of the blade was on the edge of my aorta, the main artery. And once that's punctured, you're drowned in your own blood. That's the end of you. It came out in the New York Times the next morning that if I had merely sneezed, I would have died. Well, about 4 days later, they allowed me, after the operation, after my chest had been opened and the blade had been taken out, to move around in the wheelchair in the hospital. They allowed me to read some of the mail that came in, and from all over the states and the world, kind letters came in. I read a few, but one of them I will never forget. I had received one from the president and the vice president. I've forgotten what those telegrams said. I'd received a visit and a letter from the governor of New York, but I've forgotten what that letter said. But there was another letter that came from a little girl, a young girl, who was a student at the White Plains High School. And I looked at that letter, and I'll never forget it. Said simply, "Dear Dr. King, I am a ninth grade student at the White Plains High School." She said, "While it should not matter, I would like to mention that I'm a white girl. I read in the paper of your misfortune and of your suffering. And I read that if you had sneezed, you would have died. I'm simply writing you to say that I'm so happy that you didn't sneeze. And I want to say tonight, that I too am happy that I didn't sneeze, because if I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1960 when students all over the South started sitting in at lunch counters. And I knew that as they were sitting in, they were really standing up for the best in the American dream and taking the whole nation back to those great wells of democracy which were dug deep by the founding fathers in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1961 when we decided to take a ride for freedom and ended segregation in interstate travel. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1962. The Negroes in Albany, Georgia decided to straighten their backs up. And whenever men and women straighten their backs up, they are going somewhere, because a man can't ride your back unless it is bent. If I had sneezed, if I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been here in 1963. The black people of Birmingham, Alabama, aroused the conscience of this nation and brought into being the Civil Rights Bill. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have had a chance later that year in August to try to tell America about a dream that I had had. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been down in Selma, Alabama to see the great movement there. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been in Memphis to see a community rally around those brothers and sisters who are suffering. I'm so happy that I didn't sneeze. And they were telling me. Now it doesn't matter now. It really doesn't matter what happens now. I left Atlanta this morning, and as we got started on the plane, there were six of us. The pilot said over the public address system, "We are sorry for the delay, but we have Dr. Martin Luther King on the plane, and to be sure that all of the bags were checked, and to be sure that nothing would be wrong on the plane, we had to check out everything carefully, and we've had the plane protected and guarded all night." And then I got into Memphis, and some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out, or what would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Welcome back. And that was the final will and testament of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., his final speech and sermon delivered at Mason Temple in Memphis, Tennessee, on the evening of April 3rd, 1968. And yesterday represented the 56th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in Memphis, Tennessee, as he lended assistance to the sanitation worker strike that had been going on at that time for some 2 years, 2 months. And of course, you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for this Friday, April 5th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of our program for this week. That was Love, led by Arthur Lee and Johnny Echols from the third album entitled Forever Changes. That track was called The Daily Planet. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast for April 5th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. On April 4th, the following day from the previous segment, Dr. King was assassinated right after 6 p.m. Memphis Central Time on April 4th of 1968. Let's listen to the reports that came in through the National Wire Services during that time period on April 4th of 1968.
From the WCTO Radio News Bulletin, this bulletin just in, Dr. Martin Luther King was shot outside a Memphis hotel this afternoon. His condition was not immediately known. Once again, Dr. Martin Luther King was shot outside a Memphis hotel this afternoon. His condition was not immediately known. Stay tuned to WCTO Radio for further details.
The 620 Sports is brought to you by Swanberg and Chiefy Buick.
We'll have the weather with Dick Enroth in just a moment. Further details on the Dr. Martin Luther King incident now. King was shot outside a Memphis hotel this afternoon. His condition was not known immediately. Police put out a wanted bulletin for what they described as a young white male, well-dressed. They said the man was seen running from a brick building across the street. The shooting took place near the Lorraine Hotel in Memphis, where King's car was parked. Police said King was sitting in his car when the shot was fired. Officers raced to the scene and surrounded the car. Other units roared into the area and surrounded the hotel. Early reports indicate police had recovered the weapon used in that shooting. King was in Memphis, Tennessee, leading garbage strike marches. His march last Wednesday burst into violence that left one dead, 62 injured, and 200 arrested, and he had planned another mass march for next Monday. Police said the assailant dropped the weapon while running down the main street about one block from the shooting. They said the assailant apparently jumped into a late model car after the shooting and sped away. So Dr. Martin Luther King shot outside a Memphis hotel this afternoon, and as yet his condition not immediately known. Stay tuned to CCO Radio for further developments on that story. Now the weather story, official weather.
We interrupt this program for a CBS Radio Net Alert Bulletin.
This is Douglas Edwards, CBS News, New York. Civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. was shot at a downtown Memphis hotel shortly before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time this evening. A direct report now from Memphis, Frank Gardner of WREC reporting.
Dr. Martin Luther King has been shot and wounded, possibly critically wounded, in Memphis, Tennessee this evening. Police describe a young, well-dressed, medium-built white male driving a white Mustang, shot at and wounded, possibly critically wounded, Dr. Martin Luther King at his motel room in the downtown area of Memphis this evening. Dr. King reportedly was hit in the face. The extent of his injuries are not known at this moment, but one observer at the hospital, at St. Joseph Hospital here in Memphis, told this reporter Dr. King apparently had been hit and was wounded badly. He was hit in the face, and at last report was being given oxygen. He entered the hospital emergency room with his face covered with a towel. The exact extent of his injuries not known at this time. Apparently, the man responsible for the shooting of Dr. King here in Memphis this evening has not been apprehended. This is Frank Gardner in Memphis.
A hospital spokesman has told CBS News that the condition of Dr. Martin Luther King is critical. This is CBS News in New York.
This is your good neighbor to the Northwest with studios, St. Paul, Minneapolis at 830 WCCO. Once again, Dr. Martin Luther King was shot outside a Memphis hotel this afternoon. His condition now reported as critical. Stay tuned to WCCO Radio for further details. We'll have music on the go coming up in just 5 minutes. Civil rights leader Martin Luther King has been shot in a downtown Memphis hotel. Police say that King was removed from the hotel where he was shot and taken by ambulance to a Memphis hospital. No immediate word on the extent of his injuries. However, CBS Radio just a short time ago reported his condition as critical. And that shooting occurred shortly before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Police put out a wanted bulletin for what they described as a young white male, well-dressed. And they said the man was seen running from a brick building just across the street. That shooting, by the way, took place near the Lorraine Hotel in Memphis, where King's car was parked. Police say that King was sitting in his car when the shot was fired. The officers raced to the scene and surrounded the car. Other units then surrounded the hotel. And early reports indicate the police had recovered the weapon used in the shooting. The man apparently dropped the weapon after running and then jumping into a late model car and speeding away. So that is the latest word on the Dr. Martin Luther King shooting in downtown Memphis, Tennessee. And we'll keep you right up to date on that story. We've had so many late-breaking developments here in the last week. And you'll hear all the news, complete, authoritative, and concise, right here on 830 WCCO.
Checking the tread depths on tires, chemically analyzing transmission fluids, and determining the accuracy of speedometers.
Now this late bulletin from the WCCO Radio News Bureau. Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., 1964 Nobel Peace Prize winner and America's leading exponent of nonviolence in the civil rights struggle, was shot to death Thursday night, according to Assistant Police Chief Henry Lux. This just into our WCCO Radio News Bureau. Dr. Martin Luther King apparently shot in the back of the neck while standing on his hotel balcony late today in Memphis, Tennessee. Police rushed to the civil rights leader and then rushed him to a hospital in critical condition. And the word just in now that Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., Nobel Peace Prize winner, has died in Memphis, Tennessee. Keep tuned to WCCO Radio for further developments. The time now is 20 minutes after 7 o'clock. In the Twin Cities, we have 30 degrees.
We interrupt this program for a CBS Radio Net Alert Bulletin.
This is Gary Shepard, CBS News, New York. Civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King died tonight in Memphis, Tennessee, after being shot in the face by an unknown assailant on the balcony in front of a downtown hotel a short while ago. Associated Press says Assistant Police Chief Henry Lux of Memphis confirmed Dr. King's death. Reverend Dr. King, winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, was 39 years old. He was in Memphis to lead demonstrations in sympathy with a prolonged strike by municipal garbage men, most of them Negro. Police at last report were still looking for a young white male who was seen running from the scene of the shooting and reportedly dropped the weapon in flight. Frank Gardner, a reporter for CBS station WREC in Memphis, speaks of talking with a surgeon at the hospital who has been in contact moments before with an associate of Dr. King who was in the pediatrics division of the hospital. The surgeon, who was a friend of the other doctor, said they told him that Dr. King died about 15 minutes ago. We repeat, Dr. Martin Luther King, America's nonviolent civil rights leader, shot and killed tonight in Memphis, Tennessee. Gary Shepard, CBS News, New York.
At this time, we resume the regular program schedule from other studios on this CBS Radio Net Alert station.
You can take Salem out of the country,
the news is breaking fast, and you're right there with CBS Radio Net Alert and WCCO Radio, where you hear history as it happens. Unfortunately, some rather bad history tonight. We'll keep you abreast of late developments here on CCO Radio. 23 minutes now past 7 in the Twin Cities, 30 degrees. Simon and Garfunkel. Dr. Martin Luther King was shot to death in Memphis tonight. The news of King's death was announced by Assistant Police Chief Henry Lux. King was shot as he stood on the balcony of a Memphis motel where he was staying. Police say two unidentified men were taken into custody several blocks from where King was shot. The executive vice president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the Reverend Andrew Young, says the shot hit King in the neck and the lower part of his face. And Young added, he didn't say a word. He didn't move. King was rushed to St. Joseph's Hospital immediately after the shooting, and he was declared dead at the hospital a short time later. Late news from Memphis, Tennessee this evening. Some very, very bad news. In the sports scene tonight, from Studio St. Paul, Minneapolis at 830, this is WCCO. And now the world tonight with Gary Shepard.
This is Gary Shepard, CBS News, New York. Civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King died tonight in Memphis, Tennessee, after being shot in the face by an unknown assailant on the balcony in front of a downtown hotel a short while ago. Associated Press says Assistant Police Chief Henry Lux of Memphis confirmed Dr. King's death. Reverend Dr. King, winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, was 39 years old. He was in Memphis to lead demonstrations in sympathy with a prolonged strike by municipal garbage men, most of them Negro. Police at last report were still looking for a young white male who was seen running from the scene of the shooting and reportedly dropped the weapon in flight. Frank Gardner, a reporter for CBS station WREC in Memphis, speaks of talking with a surgeon at the hospital who has been in contact moments before with an associate of Dr. King who is in the pediatrics division of the hospital. The surgeon, who is a friend of the other doctor, said they told him that Dr. King died about 15 minutes ago. We repeat, Dr. Martin Luther King, America's nonviolent civil rights leader, shot and killed tonight in Memphis, Tennessee. Gary Shepard, CBS News, New York.
The World Tonight will continue in a moment.
We interrupt this program for a CBS Radio Net Alert Bulletin.
This is Daniel Shore, CBS News, Washington. The Reverend Martin Luther King has been shot and killed in Memphis, shot as he stood alone on the balcony of his hotel, and he died soon afterward in the hospital. We are now standing by at the White House for a statement expected momentarily from President Johnson. And while we wait for him to appear in the rain-swept streets in front of the White House, delaying his own arrival at a dinner for congressional Democrats, we will give you some of the details. The police in Memphis have issued a bulletin for a young white man who was seen darting out of a building across the street from the hotel where the Reverend Martin Luther King was staying. Dr. King's chauffeur said that he was standing on the street when Dr. King strolled out onto the second floor balcony moments before he was to leave for dinner at the home of the Reverend Billy Kiles, a Negro minister. Jones, the chauffeur, said that King told me to stop the car. He was ready to go to dinner. I said, to the chauffeur, it's cold outside, Dr. King. Put your top coat on. And he said, okay, I will, and he smiled. And those were his last words. I heard the gun, said the chauffeur. Dr. King fell on his back. He had been looking directly at the man. The identity of the man is still not known. There have been reports that two white persons have been picked up. It is not clear from these wire service reports whether they had any connection with the assassination. The Reverend Andrew Young, who is the executive vice president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which was headed by Dr. King and which was planning a march on Washington on April 22nd on behalf of poor people, said that the shot hit Dr. King in the neck and the lower right part of his face. Dr. Young said he didn't say a word. He didn't move. Immediately after the shooting, the civil rights leader was rushed to St. Joseph's Hospital, where he was declared dead a short time later. Police armed with rifles have blocked the front entrance to the hospital to hold back a crowd which gathered there quickly. Dr. King had come to Memphis only yesterday to take charge of the continuing demonstrations in support of the city's striking garbage collectors. A march which Dr. King had led last Thursday erupted into rioting in which one person was killed. And now Dr. King had planned another march for next Monday. National Guard troops have rushed to Memphis to quell last week's riot, but they have not been on hand since. Governor Ellington has been alerted that Dr. King was shot, and he was conferring with Memphis authorities and state officials. No decision was announced immediately on whether the National Guard would be returned to Memphis. As we reported previously, the police in Memphis have put out a wanted bulletin for a young white male, well-dressed, who was seen running from a brick building across the street from the hotel where Dr. King's car was parked at the time of the shooting. It is now reported that police have been chasing a late model blue car through Memphis and north to nearby Millington. They reported a civilian in a car with a Citizens Band radio had closed on the car and had opened fire on it. The microphones have been set up in front of the door to the White House, and a White House aide has said that President Johnson will come out momentarily to make what is expected to be his statement on what is perhaps the most tragic assassination since the assassination of President Kennedy. We were speaking earlier to the office of the SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, here in Washington, which was planning the Poor People's March on Washington for April 2nd, where they reported that they were in a state of such shock that they would not comment immediately. Stokely Carmichael, the head of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, had planned a news conference for tomorrow, first canceled, and now he says he will go through with the news conference. This is perhaps one of the acts which may help to weld together the divided Negro community. The reports still coming in from Memphis say that the shot fired at Dr. King apparently came from a brick building across the street from the hotel. There were three white males in the car which the police have been pursuing. More than 100 police and sheriff's deputies have sealed off a five-square block area of Memphis around the hotel. Hundreds of spectators have been flooding around the cordon. Here in Washington, the FBI says that it is investigating the shooting at the specific request of Attorney General Ramsey Clark. The reports coming in from Memphis indicate the Negro community in a state of shock. The Reverend W. Herbert Berter said, "Oh my God, oh my God." In Atlanta, the wife of Dr. King prepared to fly to Memphis immediately. "I was just told he had been shot," she said. "The report I got was in the shoulder, and he was in serious condition." Later, it turned out that Dr. King had died in the hospital. It was, incidentally, the same hospital where James Meredith was taken after his ambush wounding in Hernando, Mississippi, south of Memphis in June 1965. Dr. King, as we said, was in Memphis to lead a massive march on Monday to prove, in the face of last week's riot in Memphis, that he could conduct a peaceful march. His attorneys had gone to court on Thursday to challenge a federal court ban on that march. They said that his march would be orderly and peaceful. The arguments, which were being heard by U.S. District Judge Bailey Brown, had continued late into the day. At the request of the city, Judge Brown had issued a temporary restraining order preventing Dr. King, his associates, or other outsiders from staging a march in Memphis. A demonstration led by Dr. King a week ago caused violence or resulted in one death, 62 injuries, and more than 270 arrests. The first comment from the administration here in Washington has come from Vice President Hubert Humphrey. He said tonight that the assassination of Dr. King brings shame to our country. He predicted that the slaying of the civil rights leader will bring new strength to the cause for which Dr. King had fought. The vice president said, and we quote his statement, "Martin Luther King's death is a tragedy and a sorrow to his family and to our nation. The criminal act that took his life brings shame to our country. An apostle of nonviolence has been the victim of violence. The cause for which he marched and worked will find new strength. The blight of discrimination, poverty, and neglect must be erased from America. An America of full freedom, full and equal opportunity shall be his living memorial." That is a statement of Vice President Humphrey. We are expecting now a statement from President Johnson. That statement, we were told, will come in about 2 minutes from now. As we have reported, the Reverend Martin Luther King has been fatally shot in Memphis. And tonight, with the first statement already issued by Vice President Humphrey, President Johnson has delayed his departure for a Democratic congressional dinner in order to make a statement on his own behalf. The president is scheduled tonight to leave for Honolulu by way of California, where tomorrow he is to confer with former President Eisenhower. In a period of rapid surprises and shocks, this is the latest to disrupt the schedule of the president and the schedules of many of us. The lights glare on the door of the White House. Presidential news assistant Robert Fleming has said that momentarily the president is expected to make a statement. The microphones are set up in the rain. The reporters are waiting. And soon we expect to hear the voice of the president. President Johnson had known Dr. King. They had seen each other often. He had once advised him at a news conference that it would not be wise for him to prepare this march on Washington. It appears now that there is some delay in the president's statement, We will return to hear the president. Meanwhile, this is Daniel Shore, CBS News, Washington.
At this time, we resume the regular program schedule from other studios on this CBS Radio Net Alert station.
This is your good neighbor to the northwest with studio St. Paul, Minneapolis at 830 WCCO.
This is Douglas Edwards, CBS News, New York. We now switch you to Washington.
This is Daniel Shore, CBS News, Washington. We are awaiting momentarily a statement by President Johnson at the White House on the fatal shooting of Dr. Martin Luther King in Memphis. Dr. King was shot as he stood on a hotel balcony as he was preparing to go out for dinner. At the White House, the microphones have been set up. There are floodlights on the door, and President Johnson is now about to appear.
America is shocked and saddened by the brutal slaying tonight of Dr. Martin Luther King. I ask every citizen to reject the blind violence that has struck Dr. King, who lived by nonviolence. I pray that his family can find comfort in the memory of all he tried to do for the land he loved so well. I have just conveyed the sympathy of Ms. Johnson, myself, to his widow, Mrs. King. I know that every American of goodwill joins me in mourning the death of this outstanding leader and in praying for peace and understanding throughout this land. We can achieve nothing by lawlessness and divisiveness among the American people. It's only by joining together and only by working together can we continue to move toward equality and fulfillment for all of our people. I hope that all Americans tonight will search their hearts as they ponder this most tragic incident. I have canceled my plans for the evening. I am postponing my trip to Hawaii until tomorrow. Thank you.
President Johnson speaking from the White House. The plan that he canceled was his plan to attend a Democratic congressional dinner here in Washington tonight. And as you heard, he will delay his trip to Hawaii tomorrow, but apparently still intends to go to Honolulu for his meeting with American leaders coming in from Saigon. That was the President of the United States on the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. Daniel Shore, CBS News, Washington.
Welcome back. And those were some of the headlines coming out on the evening of April 4th of 1968. Let's listen to developments the following day, April 5th, 1968.
This is Douglas Edwards, CBS News in New York, with a special report on Martin Luther King, The Aftermath. This is the day after Martin Luther King died, and the American Negro community is clearly angry, often uncontrollably angry, over his murder. In the CBS newsroom in New York, it's difficult to keep track of all the cities where sporadic violence has occurred in Negro sections since the bullet of the unknown white gunman cut down the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King in Memphis, Tennessee, yesterday. Let's begin this special report with a look at those places where the disturbances seem most severe. The CBS radio affiliate in Chicago, WBBM, reports five people dead from burns and bullet wounds in an outbreak of arson, sniping, and looting, mainly on the Negro West Side. CBS newsman Jed Duvall saw the Chicago story unfold today.
It began this morning in Chicago when thousands of Negro schoolchildren failed to show up for classes, an apparent reaction to the slaying of Dr. King. And now it has come to this. The incessant and urgent chatter heard on the two-way radio of a fire engine parked in the heart of the burning and looting on Chicago's west side. Perhaps half the fire engines in this city are out fighting fires in a 16-block area. Through the day, the children who stayed out of school roamed the large, dismal, crowded black sections of Chicago. More and more often through the early afternoon, windows of stores were broken. Police were challenged and taunted. During the evening rush hour, it became a full-blown riot. Looting reports came in one on top of another. On Warren Street, we watched a young man carrying a shopping bag stuffed with fresh meat, steaks. He stumbled, spilling the bag to the pavement, nearly at the foot of a police officer. Neither the officer nor the looter paid any attention to the other. The loot was scooped up, and the youth walked away. Restaurants and stores throughout the city closed early. Many office workers, apparently sensing trouble, went home in mid-afternoon. Shortly after dark, the olive drab of the Illinois National Guard was first seen on the streets in the riot area. 6,000 guardsmen had been alerted during the afternoon as the vandalism and looting reached alarming proportions. By the time Mayor Daley was on television appealing for calm and order, several buildings on West Madison Street were ablaze. Countless scores of stores all over the city had been looted. One factor on the side of the police is the cool weather. Chicago expects lows in the 20s tonight, and that might help. It's much colder than it will be in July. Jed Duval, CBS News, Chicago.
Police in Detroit report an 18-year-old Negro youth was shot and killed tonight while being arrested with 19 other youths for what the police describe as looting. For the general picture in Detroit, site of the worst riot in the nation's history last summer, here's Jim McQuarrie of CBS radio affiliate WJR.
Listening to police radios here in Detroit, one is jerked backward in time to the humid July days of last year when the nation's worst riot was in progress. The significant difference this time, the city police, state police, and National Guardsmen are on the job at the very beginning. Last night, Detroit, like all American cities, was too numb to act or react to news of Dr. King's death. Today, some overreaction. At mid-morning, the first violent acts were reported as small gangs of youths roamed the still riot-scarred sections of Detroit, throwing bricks, bottles, and rocks through windows. The activity was unorganized, and there were no injuries at that time. Early this morning, squads of state troopers moved into Detroit to beef up the city police. Detroit Mayor Jerome Cavanaugh declared a state of emergency this afternoon and clamped a curfew of 8 p.m. to 5 a.m. on the city. Sales of liquor and gasoline were stopped. At this hour, one accidental shooting in suburban Highland Park as police were arresting looters. There have been three non-fatal shootings, one policeman injured, and four civilians. No details are being released other than the cold statistics. Governor Romney flew into Detroit late this afternoon. Tonight, he and Mayor Cavanaugh toured Detroit and both agreed that the preventive police and National Guard effort has been successful in buttoning down large-scale violence, at least up to this point in time. There is still the weekend to come. This is Jim McQuarrie in Detroit.
Some of the worst trouble of the day occurred in Washington, D.C., the very heart of the nation. Tonight, the White House and the Capitol are surrounded by federal troops. They were brought in on the orders of President Johnson. For a late report on the situation in Washington, we go to CBS newsman Tony Sargent.
At least 4,000 National Guard and federal troops are in this uneasy town tonight, and more stand ready. Most are equipped with M16 rifles, helmets, and gas masks. Some tanks have been brought in. 1,000 city police are on duty. In many of these streets, the troops and police are the only visible figures, but in others, looters still roam, adding to the so far uncounted number of items hauled from broken store windows in this town starting as early as midday, as close as two blocks from the White House. At least 100 fires have been ignited. Several are burning out of control at this hour, but overall the fires are diminishing. One just opposite me, here in the Negro part of town, is now being brought gradually under control by Washington firefighters.
Hey, how you doing? This is James Lewis.
Right. Police report having made more than 600 arrests, with over half these still in custody. Three deaths have been reported so far. Walter Washington, the mayor of this city, imposed a curfew at 5:30. As that curfew fell, thousands of motorists were choking the streets, heading towards suburban homes, weekend holidays, or just outward for the sake of it. The tourists have also been leaving in droves. Airlines report jammed ticket counters. One thing they came here for has been nipped in the bud by these riots. The annual Cherry Blossom Festival that would have climaxed this weekend has been canceled entirely. And even the opening day baseball game, originally set for Monday, now has been postponed at least one day. Tony Sargent, CBS News, in the riot area of Washington.
Memphis, Tennessee is, of course, the focal point. The past 24 hours of tragedy and the ensuing violence began there. And for a late report from the scene, here is CBS News reporter Ed Rabel.
While other American cities are seething with unrest, Memphis, the center of tension following the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., has thus far been spared major outbreaks of violence. There are different explanations for the lack of violence here. Police say their show of force is responsible, while Negro leaders credit their influence in the Negro community as the deciding factor. Despite all this, Memphis has had problems. Frank Holloman, the director of public safety in Memphis, made this statement earlier today.
The looting and sniping and arson activities in Memphis has tapered off. It has lessened, although there is some sporadic activities still going on at the present time.
Reports of sporadic looting and rioting are still coming in tonight, but a curfew enforced by 4,000 National Guardsmen and police tactical units is generally being obeyed, and for the most part, Memphis is calm. Ed Rabel, CBS News, Memphis.
The nation's first major riot since World War II took place in Watts, the Negro district of Los Angeles. But that area is generally quiet tonight, as we hear from CBS News correspondent Bill Stout.
One surprise in this day of anguish and turmoil was the reaction in Watts, the Negro ghetto of Los Angeles, scene of the first of the big city riots. A surprise because, so far at least, there has been virtually no trouble. Several schools were dismissed early, some before noon, and thousands of young people crowded the streets and the sidewalks and the parks, but there were no riots, no looting, no cars overturned. An incident here and there, to be sure, but nothing like the bloodbath of 3 years ago. Partly that's due to the restraint of news people and police. Unlike the riot time of 1965, this situation brought no rush of armed officers and cameramen and reporters into the middle of the ghetto. Several investigations since then, from Watts to Harlem and Newark, have produced evidence that news coverage alone can add to the trouble. But this time, the news teams held back, the police held back, and Negro leaders, militants, and moderates alike moved in to try to head off the trouble. So far, thanks to the calming elements and to the people themselves, there has been little or no trouble, though, of course, it could change in a matter of minutes. Other effects in this area, Senator Eugene McCarthy canceled the rest of his California and Oregon campaign schedule. He'll return to Washington in the morning. And looking ahead to the Oscars, the Academy Awards ceremony Monday evening, four Negro stars have canceled out: Sidney Poitier, Diane Carroll, Sammy Davis Jr., and Louis Armstrong. But all this is precautionary. So far, no violence. Bill Stout, CBS News, Los Angeles.
National Guardsmen were also on alert tonight, or states of emergency declared, in Philadelphia, in Nashville, in the state of Mississippi. The Philadelphia story at last report was only isolated vandalism and scuffling between black and white teenagers, although it's a sad commentary on the passage of Martin Luther King to hear ourselves saying only isolated vandalism. In New York City, it's unexpectedly quiet in the Negro quarters such as Harlem or Brooklyn's Bedford-Stuyvesant, but in the Times Square area, crowds of Negroes were reported on the street, smashing windows and looting inside them. The day after Martin Luther King was murdered started with lingering unrest in the nation's Negro ghettos. As it proceeded, there were events sufficient to keep Negro reaction at a fever pitch. Dramatically, the center of attention was still in Memphis, where King's body still lay, and where his top assistant, the Reverend Ralph Abernathy, spoke over him in a memorial service.
I am the resurrection and the life, saith the Lord. I am the resurrection and the life, saith the Lord. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord.
The Reverend Abernathy, successor to Martin Luther King at the head of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and the crowds shuffling past King's coffin. Abernathy and the crowds followed King's coffin to the airport, where a New York newsman, Tony Brunton of WCBS, recorded Abernathy as he sought to restrain the mourning crowd.
We have pledged to you that we are going to carry his work forth. Now let us not do anything at this particular time that will discredit his life. He lived so nobly.
We shall overcome.
Go back to
him. We shall
overcome.
Crowd moving back now, away from the under the wing of the aircraft at the request of the Reverend Abernathy.
We shall
National Guardsmen, fixed bayonets, behind them helmeted city policemen with shotguns, submachine guns, and rifles, pushing the crowd back from time to time, asking them to move back for their own protection, as the police said. Now they have moved back at the request of the Reverend Ralph Abernathy, the man who will be taking over from Dr. King as leader of the Southern Christian Conference. He asked them to move back.
We shall overcome someday.
On the plane, chartered incidentally by New York Senator Robert Kennedy, was a grieving widow waiting to escort her husband's body back home to Atlanta. There were more keening followers at the airport, and still more at a downtown funeral parlor where the body was taken to await the funeral. It will probably be next Tuesday, with King's father, the Reverend Martin Luther King, Sr., presiding. Back in Memphis, there was still the hunt for the assassin. No one was reported in custody, but law enforcement officials were confident that someone soon would be. Confidence expressed by U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who quickly flew to Memphis from Washington to announce the full resources of the FBI were behind local and state policemen. Clark saw no evidence of a conspiracy. Police have an alarm out for one man, dark hair, medium build, between 26 and 32 years old, and, of course, white. As it was for the average citizen, this was also an upsetting day for President Johnson. There were the necessary rituals proclaiming Sunday a national day of mourning and ordering all flags on U.S. facilities down to half-staff until King is buried. But the day had deeper, more somber meanings for Mr. Johnson. CBS News White House correspondent Robert Pierpoint sums up the day from the presidential viewpoint.
Tonight from the front lawn of the White House, he could look one direction and see the dark smoke from the fires billowing overhead, another direction to the red glow of the fires themselves. From the back lawn, he could see the silent soldiers with their so far silent guns. For a president who has done more than any other in recent history for the Negro people, it was a bitter sight at the end of a dismal day. President Johnson sensed the danger last night as soon as word came of Dr. King's death, and he moved to avert it. By dawn, he had a dozen civil rights leaders moving toward the White House for a midday meeting with top administration and political leaders. The president pleaded for calm, and they agreed, but told him action was needed as well. Action long delayed to bring the Negro Americans into their full heritage. The president then announced he would speak to a joint session of Congress Monday night.
We must move with urgency and with resolve and with new energy in the Congress and in the courts and in the White House and the State House and the city halls of the nation. Wherever there is leadership, political leadership, leadership in the churches, in the homes, in the schools, in the institutions of higher learning, until we do overcome.
Late in the afternoon, after the civil rights leaders had left, President Johnson announced he had canceled his trip to Hawaii to plan Vietnam's strategy. Instead, General Westmoreland is flying to Washington. Meantime, the violence and the arson and the looting worsened to the point where a saddened president was finally forced to call in federal troops to protect the nation's capital from embittered fellow Americans whom he had tried to help. Robert Pierpoint, CBS News, at the White House.
On the state level, President Johnson was emulated almost to a carbon copy by a man many insist is still a potential Republican candidate for the White House, New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller. Rockefeller appeared on statewide radio and television tonight. He officially proclaimed Sunday a state day of mourning, and he ordered flags on state facilities flown at half staff. He also announced he'd send a special message to the legislature in Albany next Monday, urging swift passage of social welfare bills, saying Americans must redeem their honor not with words, but with deeds.
There will be fighting in our streets so long as there is fighting in our hearts. The black citizens can pay no tribute to this man of peace with bricks or guns. Only with courage and dignity that he proudly expected from his people. And the white citizens can pay no tribute to this man of peace merely by weeping upon his death, only by honoring, at last and in full, the principles of brotherhood for which he gave his life. I shall send to the state legislature this Monday a special message urging that such deeds quickly become law. There already is before the legislature a series of measures vitally affecting the lives of all our Negro citizens, jobs and health, housing, education and training. The enactment of these measures will give witness to our profound vow, our vow not merely to talk, but to act, so that Martin Luther King's dream of America becomes the life of America.
Robert Kennedy interrupted his campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination today, but he did keep a speaking engagement at the Civic Club in Cleveland, not to speak about politics, but instead to denounce the senseless violence that struck Martin Luther King down.
Victims of the violence are black and white, rich and poor, young and old, famous and unknown. They are most important of all, human beings whom other human beings loved and needed. No one, no matter where he lives or what he does, can be certain who next will suffer from some senseless act of bloodshed. And yet it goes on and on and on in this country of ours. Why?
In another part of town, Cleveland's Negro mayor, Carl Stokes, was eulogizing Martin Luther King at a memorial service.
You can kill a man, but you cannot kill an idea. And the idea and the ideals for which Dr. Martin Luther King stood, for which he lived, and for which he died, will continue to live in this country, will continue to live in this city. And despite the sorrow upon under which all of us today feel so heavy, there will on tomorrow be a resurgence of the confidence that he was right, and that we will overcome.
Like many another public official today, Cleveland's Mayor Carl Stokes had tears visible in his eyes as he stood to eulogize the late Reverend Martin Luther King. What comes next? The main moves are probably with President Johnson when he speaks to Congress next Monday night. What will he call for? Another reporter on the CBS News White House beat, correspondent Dan Rather, has some thoughts.
What the president wants to propose to Congress Monday is a great leap forward for social justice. An open housing bill, certainly. But it is spelt here, there must be more than that. Mr. Johnson has been talking to civil rights leaders by the dozens, white and black, but mostly black, in the White House, by telephone, and through intermediaries. The black leaders have many suggestions. Most cost money, much money, and that's the hang-up. Whitney Young, director of the National Urban League, for example, has revived the idea of a domestic Marshall Plan, a huge spending program in decaying urban areas, jobs and housing on an unprecedented scale for the black poor. Caught in the fiscal vice formed by spiraling war costs on one side and skyrocketing deficits on the other, Mr. Johnson's options are few. Quick passage of the open housing bill and a stepped-up program for jobs cost the least. They are likely to get the heaviest emphasis in the Monday speech to Congress. Dan Rather, CBS News, The White House.
The wide range of reaction to Dr. King's death generally had one element in common, emotion, indicating this was one of those momentous incidents that hit most of us where we really live. Consider two statements from polar extremes. One from Jacqueline Kennedy in New York, who herself lost a husband to an assassin's bullet. The president's widow says she weeps for Mrs. King and her children and prays we'll now find more room in our hearts for love and justice. Mrs. Kennedy makes it difficult for us to sit passively in self-righteous condemnation of King's assassin when she points out, some people would never kill, but even to speak of another with hatred is the same and causes death. The former First Lady also adds, when will our country learn that to live by the sword is to perish by the sword? This in contrast to Black Power militant Stokely Carmichael, who in Washington today said, white America declared war on Black America last night. As Carmichael saw it, there is no need for a lot of intellectual talk now. That's all over. We will wait, but only until we can get enough guns. What is needed now are guns and more guns. The judgment of Stokely Carmichael. The American tragedy of Martin Luther King's murder has brought an outpouring of universal reaction. Pope Paul VI urged calm and respect for the principle of brotherly love. Great Britain's Parliament expressed horror at what it termed this brutal and senseless murder. In Africa, where King was a hero, his assassination brought praise for the man from statesmen and predictions of widespread violence in America's cities. UN Secretary General U Thant, now in Geneva, sent a message of sympathy to Mrs. King. A similar message went to the bereaved widow from Sweden's King Gustav, who presented the Nobel Peace Prize to the civil rights leader back in the year 1964. Another CBS News Washington correspondent, Eric Severide, was one of those with tears in his eyes as he recorded this evaluation of that noted American, Martin Luther King.
We have all been told that we live in a bland and cautious time and are bereft of heroes. We have been told that our generation is as embarrassed in the presence of the noble as our ancestors were embarrassed in the presence of the base. The life of Martin Luther King denies the first assumption. The reaction to his death denies the second. Almost surely, he was the most important American of his time, white or black. He, more than any other man, wielded the cutting edge of history for this time and place. He preached love, so hate, of course, destroyed him, as it destroyed 2,000 years ago the man whose gospel he followed, as it destroyed 20 years ago in India the man whose strategies he adopted. Saints are usually killed by their own people. Dr. King was not. He was not an American Negro. He was a Negro American. As Dr. Abernathy once said of King, he seeks to save the nation and its soul, not just the Negro. King grasped a white man by his shoulder, forced him to turn around and looked long and hard upon his fellow black American. To some, the sight was frightening. To many others, the landscape of our lives looked richer and full of much greater promise. There are those who proclaim that white society killed Dr. King. Democracy cannot function under such a theory. To blame everyone is to blame no one. Only the Hitlers of this world and their spiritual kin, like young Mr. Carmichael, believe in mass guilt and in genocide as justice. There are those who proclaim that this is a sick society. It is a society containing many sick individuals, white and black, including the moral invalid who fired the shot last night. It is doubtful if this nation has ever before gone into officially proclaimed mourning, its flags everywhere at half-staff, over the death of a private citizen. And this man was a descendant of slaves. This is not the reaction of a sick society, but of a fundamentally healthy society trying desperately to cleanse itself of the one chronic, persistent poison in its body. So the label on his life must not be a long day's journey into night. It must be a long night's journey into day. This is Eric Severide in Washington.
Now tonight, the vast majority of Americans, black and white, are holding their breath and hoping the poison works its way through our systems quickly and as painlessly as possible. As an outspoken voice for civil rights, Negro entertainer Sammy Davis Jr., speaking in New York to CBS News reporter Josh Darsa, was one of those urging moderation on his companions.
I plead, if there's ever been a black brother or a sister that's ever heard me and felt that maybe I had something to say, I beg them to hold their emotions in check. We cannot desecrate what this man stood for. I think that the man who goes out and loots at this point is maybe only two steps lower than the man who shot down King. The black man said to me, I am so angry with my country, I am so upset, and I want to burn down the ghetto that I live in. I can emotionally agree with that, but if he tells me I want to break down a liquor store and loot a liquor store or steal shoes, then I think we're defeating everything that this man stood for. And I think that now is the time for the militant leaders to say, all right, baby, let's hold ourselves. You're angry, you're mad, man. Let's hold it now and see if Whitey's going to come up with it.
Will Whitey come up with it, and will U.S. Negroes wait until he does? These the questions black and white Americans are asking tonight, both factions poorer, now that Martin Luther King is no longer around to help find a peaceful.
Welcome back, and that was a series of CBS News reports on the situation the day after the martyrdom of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on April 4th, 1968. That was a report from April 5th. Here's the evening news report on April 5th, 1968, just one day after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Direct from our newsroom in New York, in color, this is the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite and Eric Severide in Washington, Steve Rowan in Washington, Dan Rather at the White House, Ike Pappas in Memphis, Bill Plant in Memphis, Peter Burns in Atlanta, John Hart in Cleveland, and Bert Quint in Quezon, South Vietnam.
Good evening. The body of Dr. Martin Luther King was returned to his home in Atlanta today as authorities in Memphis expressed confidence that his slayer soon will be captured. President Johnson appealed nationally for calm, asking all citizens to deny violence its victory. Nevertheless, the murder sent a shockwave of violence rolling through the big cities of America, and the worst trouble was in Washington, virtually on the president's doorstep. Late today, the president declared a state of emergency and regular army troops moved into the nation's capital to protect strategic locations from the violence spreading through the city. Steve Rowan reports.
A stiff breeze fanned the flames of more than half a dozen fires set by looters along 7th Street, and the wind quickly dispersed the tear gas used by police in their only attempts to stop the looting. The looters were mostly young Negro men and women, as well as boys down to the age of 6 or 7. They hit the liquor stores first, then went for clothing stores, appliance stores, and other shops. They roamed back and forth across 7th Street, unhindered by the police, cheering as another plate glass window caved in, laughing at each other as they emerged with armloads of loot. There was little talk of Martin Luther King, just an occasional bitter remark from someone, usually someone not involved in the looting, about the white so-and-so who shot the civil rights leader. A few of them were arrested, usually when they ran into the arms of officers with their loot. And as the afternoon wore on, they stripped just about every store along an 8-block stretch of the street, taking more than they could ever use themselves, discarding what didn't fit or wasn't the right color on the sidewalks outside. Half a dozen police cars stood by, and from time to time, a few of the officers would put on their gas masks, take a few canisters of tear gas, and walk up the street, chasing the looters away for a few minutes. But as soon as they passed, the looting continued. From the air, the scene looked unreal. A row of fires in the middle of an otherwise tranquil city. But everyone knows that this city is not tranquil, that a flare-up of violence has been threatening for years. And Mayor Walter Washington moved this afternoon to prevent real violence, real bloodshed, by imposing a curfew on Washington from 5:30 p.m. to 6:30 a.m. This was to have been
the weekend for Washington's Cherry Blossom Festival, but all the events of that annual celebration were canceled. A few Negroes complained of police violence, but there was little of it. The officers did take a number of Negroes into police custody, arrested them in the act of looting. As the afternoon wore on, one policeman took off his gas mask, looked around, and asked if the National Guard had been called. "We need them," he said. "We can't hold this tonight. We're losing." And indeed, the city of Washington lost much this afternoon. But the troops were called in late in the day, arriving near the White House, from which point they'll fan out. Steve Rowan, CBS News, Washington.
The violence was by no means limited to Washington. Detroit tonight is under a curfew, and National Guard troops are on duty there. Guardsmen also have been mobilized in Chicago, where five blocks of predominantly Negro West Madison Avenue were reported to fire, and where looting broke out in the downtown Loop area. And in Boston, where a menacing crowd of young Negroes kept customers trapped in a supermarket for a time. The Guard also is on duty in three cities in North Carolina and two in Tennessee. Last night or today, racial trouble also broke out in such widespread locations as Denver, Colorado, Oakland, California, and Buffalo, New York. At least four persons have been killed in the outbursts, and countless more injured or arrested.
Welcome back, and that was excerpts from the CBS Evening News on April 5th of 1968, just one day after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And we've been commemorating the 56th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, his martyrdom on April 4th of 1968 in Memphis, Tennessee, and of course the reaction around the United States to his assassination. And that's going to conclude our program for today. You've been listening to the Pan-African Journal, a worldwide radio broadcast. And today is Friday, April 5th, 2024. We've been broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. If you'd like to have access to this program, go to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. We'll close out with Detroit's own Kenny Burrell from the 1963 album entitled Freedom. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.